according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighbouring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify week by week the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power. Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together, and probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could, at the end of the day, set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made in Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallophabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called a comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country, coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and LaSalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahir, Paris.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed explanation of Surah Qamar, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Ar-Rahman, which is number 55 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 78 ayahs and is considered the crown of the Noble Quran, since it opens with the word Ar-Rahman, or the All-Beneficent, thus proclaiming one of the most beautiful attributes of the Almighty Creator. This surah highlights the all-merciful Lord's wonders of creation, describes the end of the material world, and paints an evocative picture of the delights of paradise. Hell is briefly contrasted in Ayah 43 with the joys that await the righteous. The refrain, فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ, which means, so which of your Lord's bounties will you both, mankind and jinn, deny? Runs throughout the surah, which divides mankind and jinn into three classes, the disbelievers in Ayah 41, the best of believers in Ayah 46, and the ordinary believers in Ayah 62. A hadith from the Prophet about the benefits of Surah Ar-Rahman says, whoever recites it, Allah will have mercy on his weakness and regard it as expression of gratitude. According to the Prophet's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, on the Day of Judgment, this surah will assume the form of a handsome human with wondrous fragrance and will be told by God Almighty to point out those of the believers who used to recite it. It will then be allowed to beseech God for the forgiveness of its reciters, whom the All-Merciful will pardon. Let us start with recitation of Ayahs 1, 2, 3, and 4 of Surah Ar-Rahman.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الرحمن علم القرآن خلق الإنسان علمه البيان.
In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. He taught the Quran. He created man and taught him articulate speech. The opening of the surah with God's wondrous attribute, Ar-Rahman, or the All-Beneficent, is indicative of divine blessings which are all-encompassing and benefit both believers and disbelievers in the transient life of the mortal world, even if they fail to realize these or express gratitude. The next ayah means to say that God taught and revealed the Noble Quran as the final heavenly scripture for the guidance of all mankind, to his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Ayah 3 and 4 refer to the creation of mankind as the most wondrous creature in the world of existence, and the gift of a speech coupled with intellect given to human beings in order to ensure steady progress through proper expression of words and development of the art of writing, without which we would never have been able to record events, transmit knowledge to future generations, and explore the various vistas of science. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, the all-merciful God, whose compassion is all-encompassing, showers his benefits on all creatures in the transient life of the mortal world, whether they believe in him and his commandments or not, so that there is no excuse or blame for the consequences of afterlife and the Day of Judgment, where reward and punishment will be meted out as per our deeds. Number two, the Noble Quran, with its unmatched eloquence and timeless wisdom, is the source of guidance and infinite blessings. Number three, mankind is the best of creation, and it is the Almighty Creator who is the real teacher of mankind by granting the gift of intellect and the power of speech. And number four, the ever-increasing vocabulary in the various languages spoken, along with the development of writing, ensure the progress of human societies and their mastering of science and technology, along with the firmness of faith as part of the mercy of the all-beneficent Lord. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 5 and 6 of the same surah.
الشَّمْسُ وَالْقَمَرُ بِحُسْبَانٍ وَالنَّجْمُ وَالشَّجَرُ يَسْجُدَانِ.
The sun and the moon are disposed calculatedly, and the herb and the trees prostrate to Allah. These ayahs refer to some more of the divine blessings, such as the sun and the moon, which follow their fixed courses with measured out calculation. The existence of the sun is one of the greatest divine blessings bestowed upon man, since life would be unimaginable in the solar system without its light and heat. The moon, for its part, plays a key role in human life. It is the light of the dark nights, while its gravity is the source of ebb and flow in oceans that results in life in the seas and the flowing of rivers. Besides the fixed course of the orbit of the moon around the earth and the orbit of the earth around the sun, while rotating on its axis, result in the orderly functioning of nights and days, years, months, and seasons. Consequently, the growth of different forms of vegetation, including trees, all of which provide provision to mankind and ensure coolness through the blowing of pleasant winds, are part of divine blessings. Without such order, human life and its progress could never be possible. An important point to note is the appropriate distance of the celestial bodies from each other, which means the orbit of the earth and its distance from the sun are all well calculated, without which great disruptions would occur in the solar system and consequently in human life. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the solar system, at the center of which is the sun and includes human life on planet Earth, exists as per precise calculations and functions in the most orderly manner. Number two, the entire universe has been created in a way to provide the best services to the best of creation. The human beings, most of whom, unfortunately, are ungrateful to God and destroyers of the world of nature, without realizing these wondrous divine blessings. And number three, the entire creation, including the celestial bodies as well as herbs and trees, have been created for a purpose and are obedient to the one and only Creator.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The dead bodies that were scattered in Bucha and Ukraine are a site of great concern and sadness. Russia says the images are staged, but Ukraine and its Western allies accuse Russia of being behind such atrocities in Ukraine, with the U.S. president once again calling the Russian president a war criminal that should be tried. But what about U.S. and its allies' atrocities committed in other parts of the world like Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, or Iraq? Can those be dismissed just as collateral damage? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the double standards there and ulterior motives that the U.S. may have when it comes to the Ukrainian conflict. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Ian Williams, international affairs analyst, who joins us from New York. Also joining us, Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist who joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Ian Williams, and ask you about what we have seen on Bucha and the way that it's been covered and what has occurred there. Ukraine accuses the Russian military of massacring hundreds of civilians there. Russia denies the killing of civilians and argues that the images of dead bodies have been staged. What do you think?
Yes, the Russian military almost certainly massacred hundreds of civilians there. It's their calling card. We have satellite imagery showing the bodies in the street. We have eyewitnesses seeing the bodies. We have the bodies themselves with bullets in them. We have them in the side of Russian bases. So this is a slam dunk, and no amount of protestation from Sergei Lavrov, who I knew at the United Nations and used to have more credibility than this, because he used to confess to disquiet at what the Serbs were doing, but then stood up and defended them. And now, yes, there are double standards. Yes, when Joe Biden calls for international war crimes trials of Putin and the Russians, he is quite right, as long as he says this applies to others as well, as long as it applies to the Israelis over what they did in Gaza and Lebanon. But he protects them all of the time. And this is where the United States has consistently disarmed itself and also disarmed the United Nations human rights mechanisms. Because by showing it was willing to use its veto on behalf of a proxy state, Israel, it's giving sort of carte blanche or carte blanche to the Russians to do the same. It's very difficult to put your hand on your heart and say they must be prosecuted. It's a war crime. But those aren't war crimes because they're our allies doing it. And we've been covering for them all along. And this is the fundamental hypocrisy of the situation at the moment. It's interesting watching, what we see here is very much like what we saw in Grozny. Look at those pictures of Grozny, where the Russians went to liberate the Chechens again. And now those liberated Chechens are coming and visiting the same damage on the people around Kiev and in Ukraine. There's atrocity after atrocity. And
right.
Trying to pretend that our side's atrocities don't matter, but theirs do, is really... It's worse than a crime. It's stupid.
Well,
because it means you're laying yourself open, which is what Biden's doing.
Let's break this open a little bit more. Obviously, first we need to get an idea of both sides. Tony Gosling, the Russian president, had just came out a few hours back accusing Ukrainian authorities of actually being behind this, what he has called crude and cynical provocations. If you can describe what he may mean by that. And he said this was an assessment as it was described. Again, of Kiev regime's crude and cynical provocation in the city of Bucha. What does he mean by that?
Well, you're very privileged because here in the West, we are not getting any balanced coverage. It's great to have someone to discuss and debate this with, putting both sides, as should have been being put on Monday at the UN Security Council, except the British chair of the Security Council stopped that discussion even happening. So that, of course, is what the Western media need for a propaganda blitz on one side. I think, very few of us were actually in these places at the time. And only those who were and who have access to the evidence can really make a decision and a judgment one way or the other. But I think the likelihood is, considering we had a two-day gap between when the Russians pulled out of Bucha and when these allegations were made, including with the mayor actually making no mention of this as well in the interim, so that apparently this hadn't happened in the meantime. These are bits of evidence which all need to be put together if there is to be any kind of... But I would suggest what's going on here is yet another Western provocation and accusations being thrown, which at the moment, it doesn't seem to me as if there is the really strong evidence, one side or the other, committed. We know that we have Azov battalion Nazis roaming around on the Ukrainian side, and it is absolutely possible that they are using things like sabotage, false flag, manipulation to manipulate the Western press in the propaganda war, because although the Russians seem as if they're much stronger on the ground, in the information war, I'm afraid the Russians, as Sergei Lavrov himself admitted, are really small players, and they're very, very much behind the curve. And so the NATO countries, the Western press, think that they can win through propaganda. And of course, the problem with that is if you don't get these sorts of events, the so-called Russian atrocities, which may be, and maybe Ukrainian atrocities, if you don't get the Western press interrogating these, what then happens is you can create the situation where NATO, who I believe are very much involved in Ukraine, although they like to hold their hands up and say, no, nothing to do with us. And I've got a lot of evidence for NATO carrying out atrocities through Gladio, basically picking up from the Nazi werewolves in World War II, that they may well be involved. The problem is, if this is allowed to not be interrogated in the Western press, the way it's been, this kind of what you might call propaganda blitz, blaming the Russians, when we don't really know, there's been no proper investigation yet, right. These headlines will stick in people's minds. And the thing is that these kinds of things may be used in the future to give, through the media, the West's NATO countries an excuse to get involved. Say, well, look at this atrocity. Now it's time. We must act. We must actually send NATO troops in. And, of course, we all know where that could lead.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about what you mentioned there, what Tony Gosling mentioned there, Ian Williams, about the UK. We're looking at how there should be an investigation that Russia has called for a UN Security Council meeting on this. But the UK blocked it. Why do you think the UK did that?
I think the UK blocked it in disgust, absolute disgust. And for once, I agree with this British government at the bravado and the chutzpah of the Russians committing a massacre and then saying, oh, look what they made me do. Let's get it straight. There was one day between the Russians leaving, fleeing, by the way, because they were defeated by the locals who hate them. They fled. Then reporters came in. I know some of those reporters personally. They would not lie. What did they see? They saw bodies that had visibly been lying there for days. Their fingers are black and rotten. They are buried in the earth. There are satellite pictures showing those bodies for 3 weeks before, during the Russian occupation. Independent private satellites were taking pictures. The Americans could probably provide better ones because they have better definition, but it was a private company. Other reporters came in and saw it. They went round them. Locals went in. We have eyewitness testimony from locals saying the Russians came and shot my wife, my husband, shot my children, or were doing this, that, and the other. You've got the actual Russian bases with the Russian MREs scattered around and the vodka bottles, lots of vodka bottles, which they looted from the houses, and the corpses next to them buried in their bases. I mean, this is so slam dunk. I'm very glad that Tony Gosling has at last had the temerity to admit there's a possibility that the Russians might have done it. This is a slam dunk, and it is a war crime. And yes, there are other war crimes. No amount of whataboutery about Yassin's, Sabran Shatila, what's happening in Yemen. I agree with all of those. But I have been party at the United Nations for almost 20 years at the attempt to operationalize the International Criminal Court of Justice. I supported it against Milosevic. I supported it against the Sudanese in Darfur, and I support it now against the Russians. I would also support it against the Americans if they did Milei. It was a friend of mine who broke the story of Milei, the American atrocity. But none of us ever said, what about? What about? And that is really the big cry that the Russians keep producing. They did this in Grozny before. They have committed unspeakable atrocities against their own people in the civil war.
Okay.
And this is their calling card. Look at the pictures of Grozny, look at the pictures of Kiev, and you see. It almost says, thank you, Moscow, on the bottom of that postcard.
Well, we need to talk about the past here. Tony Gosling, you can take your pick here. I have some that I noted here. Haiti, where there were indiscriminate killings of Haitians under direct command of a U.S. officer going back decades ago. Obviously, we're looking at what happened after World War II. And the Pacific War, as it was called, and it was quite interesting, some of the stuff that came out of this. The Korean War, the No Gun Rye Massacre, all of these involved U.S., and all of these involved what many say are war crimes, with hundreds and hundreds were killed. Of course, the more recent ones, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq. Which ones would you like to put into perspective for us?
Well, I'd like to look much more closely at what's been going on in Europe since the Second World War, particularly the CIA, once it was created, their support for Ukrainian Nazis as part of the US Cold War effort, the idea of false flags very much in the NATO intelligence pocket right the way through the 1980s in order to stop the Italians bringing in a communist government. Operation Gladio in Italy saw the far right in Italy actually blowing up individuals in squares and various places around Italy and blaming it on the communists. So the idea was that the far right could actually kill Italian people within Italy and then try and blame it on the Russians. Well, many people in Italy did believe it, many people didn't. They even actually assassinated Aldo Moro as well, Prime Minister. So there's been a big load of activity from the NATO intelligence services right throughout Europe. The same sort of thing going on in Belgium, by the way, when the Belgian government tried to reject US cruise missiles. And the actual pedigree of these far-right Operation Gladio forces, as many people don't know this, but at the end of the Second World War, the SS created, the Nazis created stay-behind forces that they called werewolves. Their job was to create sabotage behind enemy lines as the Allies advanced towards Berlin. And the same tactics have been used to stay behind forces, weapons caches, this sort of thing. They couldn't resist using them, and so they used them for political purposes. I think what we're looking at now is almost like the most recent phase, the most recent stage of this, quite possibly, using the same sort of tricks. And the big culprits for me are the Western press. We had, for example, no interrogation today as the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, called for the Russians to be, the Orthodox Church in Russia, to be expelled from the World Council of Churches. What they didn't tell us, that actually Rowan Williams, even though he was Archbishop of Canterbury, was initiated into the Order of Druids, which is completely the opposite of the Christian Church. And so what you had, the farce of a Druid telling the world that the Russian Orthodox Church should be ejected from the World Council of Churches with no interrogation, no background whatsoever in the Western press. So I think there's a very powerful, a very big campaign right across the Western press to demonize Russia. Paul Burrell, the former French intelligence officer, he actually called it, he said the secret code name in NATO is Operation Beluga, the idea being to discredit Russia, to discredit Putin. And of course, the idea is here that they can then get away with all sorts of stricter measures and even a potential move to a third world war against Russia if Russia could be discredited in this way. I think that's what we've been seeing over the last few days with these provocations, but I may be proved wrong. I don't like to try and come to conclusions before we've had evidence from both sides and a proper investigation.
Indeed, something that doesn't seem to actually come into fruition at this point. So Ian Williams, our guest there from Bristol, Tony Gosling, talks about the fact that both the U.S. and NATO in turn are maybe after something bigger in terms of the way that they are going after Russia. I mean, Russia at this point is the most sanctioned country in the world. I'm not too sure how much more damage they can do to Russia. Of course, economically, there's still some more damage they can do. What I'd like to ask you, Ian Williams, is in the area of negotiations. There was a particular interesting article coming out from the Washington Post that said that NATO says Ukraine to decide on peace deal with Russia, but with limits. Now, that raises question marks here. Why would there be limits on how Ukraine negotiates with Russia?
Look, I don't think the Washington Post is speaking for the government in Washington, let alone the government in Kiev. And what we've just heard is a long list of completely circumstantial, occasionally accurate diatribes about NATO. No fan of NATO, no fan of the United States, completely think that Mylae massacre should be prosecuted and dug up again. Yes, Deir Yassin and Sabra and Shatila should be prosecuted. Yes, Gaza should be prosecuted. This should be prosecuted. We have Russian troops on a sovereign United Nations member's territory. They went in unprovoked with no, there are no Ukrainian troops on Russian territory. They massacred. We have evidence, unashamed evidence from the Russians that they have used weapons of mass destruction against civilians in the cities. They've blown apart Kiev. They've blown apart the rest. So anything about Second World War preparations, werewolves, gladio, it's about as relevant as introducing the Roman gladiators into the proceedings. Yes, people were killed then. People are being killed now by Moscow. They're being killed in defiance of international law.
Well, that's
it is a crime of aggression for the Russians to go into Ukraine. It is a war crime and a violation of the Geneva Conventions
right.
to shoot prisoners, to shoot civilians. They have such a charge sheet against them, and no amount of bleating and counter-accusations. They have not shown any evidence
but
that the Ukrainians
but when
have
there
gone
are possibilities
of
talks,
of
but when there are possibilities of talks, you don't think that this is true? That perhaps there that NATO and I should say the U.S. Leading the way have motives this resolution cannot come about unless we really deal a heavy blow to Russia.
No, they've said quite strongly that it's up to the Ukrainians. It's the Ukrainians who are saying we cannot agree to terms while these evil cutthroats have a knife at our throats, are raping our women, and blowing up our children.
But they've said
I think
that
that's a fairly reasonable position.
They have said issues of global security are at stake here, and you can't just give concessions. They've blatantly said that. So Zelensky's.
Whose concessions? Somebody comes into your house, he grabs hold of your daughter, holds a knife to her throat, and then asks you why you're not conceding and being reasonable. Where is the justice in this? I think there's something missing in the state of balance. Whataboutery has gone mad here. It really has. You do not invade somebody else's country
sure.
and then blame them for imposing conditions
okay.
on talking to you. You get out of there and you say, we were wrong and we will prosecute those responsible, Putin and the generals who committed these atrocities.
Well, Tony Gosling, what do you think? I mean, again, there are reports out there, and this is not the first time, but for it to come out blatantly and say this, that, Zelensky can't come out and give concessions because, as the Western backers, they have called it, have said that any settlement to this war can't be done because there are larger issues of global security at risk. And I'm guessing
yeah,
that maybe is
that.
is perhaps pointing to China. What do you think, Tony Gosling?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, China is sitting and watching this from the background. They very much got the Russians back because they... the United States has been provoking over there too. Of course, the US has been provoking Russia in Ukraine. It's quite obvious. We had the Munich Security Conference just before the Russians invaded with Zelensky threatening to arm his army with nuclear weapons. The Russians can't just ignore that. We've also seen, by the way, today, the latest sanctions on Russia are that to stop the use of Russian coal. Now, we in Europe, we're wondering, well, okay, so we can't use Russian coal. I'm sure... Prince Charles and the rest of them, the climate people, will be very pleased about that. But this benefits the US. If there's no Russian energy coming into Europe, the United States can jack up the prices of the energy it is selling to Europe. So I think we should look at this maybe as a, in part anyway, as a kind of overreaction to what Russia's done in order to benefit US energy companies. In fact, I've seen over the years energy being used more and more in these sorts of discussions. When it comes to talks, I would like to see, very much like to see, the basic demands of Putin met. That is to say, very simple, Lugansk, Donetsk and Crimea to give up the claim on those because there was a war going on there anyway in these breakaway republics. Much better to say, well, let's give up your bombing of these places and let's just have peace there. And the other thing was just to guarantee that they wouldn't join NATO. Why on earth can Zelensky not do that? And I'll tell you why. It's because he is reading a script written in Washington. This is actually what it looks like to me.
Zelensky
is
has said
US,
he's prepared to give
US wants to sacrifice
details.
Europe. Let me finish my sentence and then you can have your say. The US wants to sacrifice Europe to weaken Russia because Russia is the only power in the world that really 100% has the moral high ground and stands up to the United States. Oh. Now, at least at last, that there's been some kind of retribution for all of the NATO activities, and they say they're not there, but they are,
okay,
in Ukraine, doing things like encouraging these Azov battalion Nazis. This is obviously a provocation to Russia, and you know they cannot allow the situation to develop as developed
invading
before
another country
when the Russians were invaded and they had basically a crisis as to whether Russia was going to exist or not. Russians can't allow that situation to develop again.
Let's bring in Ian Williams. Ian Williams, go ahead.
I mean, there's some complete absence. This is Alice in Wonderland stuff. Did Ukraine turn round to Russia and say, you must leave the Shanghai Cooperation Pact? No. It was Russia's decision to do what it wanted. Did it even say, by the way, you should get your troops out of Moldova, out of Georgia, and the other places you've occupied? No, it didn't. It stayed in its own territories. It didn't invade, and it has now been invaded. And we're talking about parity and how the Ukrainians must make concessions. This is right back to 1941. Why didn't Stalin just give up the Ukraine to Hitler then? And he could have had peace, perhaps. Or Winston Churchill, he was offered by not my favorite person, but the Germans basically said to him through back channels, you kiss and make up with us and we'll let you have the British Empire still. He said, no. It's one of the few things I admire about him. He said, no, you do not knuckle under to dictators and invaders. And the position with Ukraine and the Nazi invaders from Russia, who are Nazis in every way. They kill children. They kill people. They kill prisoners. They bomb cities. They are evil. The ruling class
in Russia 30 seconds.
Need to be dealt with.
Sorry, let's give 30 seconds in closing to Tony Gosselin. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, these are sort of ridiculous provocations, calling the Russians Nazis. We have real Nazis right now in Ukraine. The Azov battalion really do support Adolf Hitler. And they use the same sort of provocative tactics as well. That is to say, they like to create false flags, like the false flag that started the Second World War, the Gleiwitz incident, where the Nazis actually grabbed POWs and poisoned them and made it look as if to the world's press it was the Poles who were behind it.
Sorry, we're fresh out of time. I apologize for that, Tony Gosselin. Tony Gosselin, there, historian and investigative journalist. Ian Williams, thank you for your input, international affairs analyst from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoli, it's goodbye until next time. This